It's indeed a strange privilege to be standing before you today, I have to say. Before I begin this morning, though, I'd like to point something out, and that is today's my mother's birthday. She's 29 years old today. You can tell she's a lady of the South for me to say that. And I do indeed count it as an honor and a privilege to be able to stand here before you today. A couple of months ago, there had been some news stories that Union was going to try to cultivate some renewed attention to understanding the cooperative program, and I sent the president an email and said, if I can do anything to help in this process, let me know. And I meant, like, write a little essay or something like that. And he said, how about Founders Day? And I said, oh, okay. So I feel a little like the dog that chased a car and caught it and now is expected to drive. For those of you who have not had me in a class before, you need to understand something. I have a mind that works unlike most people's minds, which means today I'm going to give you an overview of the sources from which I will be quoting. Booker T. Washington, Emmy Dodd, SBC.net, Jesus Christ, Fred Durst, Gwen Stefani, Frank Sinatra, Aubrey Lucas, the Union University Catalog, John Milton, and finally O.J. Simpson. We'll see. Perhaps I was doomed, fated, providentially, whatever way you want to put it, to be a writer because I've had a strange sort of life. My parents over here have given me a number of very strange opportunities. I'm from South Mississippi. My earliest memories are of almost stepping on a rattlesnake, followed by hiding under Mom's sewing machine when a tornado was passing over the house. When I was 4, we moved to Buffalo, New York from Mississippi. Do you know what kind of torture it is to move from Mississippi to Buffalo, New York in December? I kept leaving my shoes on the school bus. I was sick for 7 years. When I was in 9th grade, Mom wrote a song for Jimmy Carter's first presidential campaign called "The Grin Will Win." I actually sang it on the tarmac at the Williamsburg Airport before the 1976 debate with Gerald Ford, with a straw hat. Do you know what that does to your 9th grade reputation? Everybody knows that to win, you got to grin, my friend. I still remember the chorus is burned into my brain. For a year, I lived on a Polish duke's estate in Virginia. I'm not making that up. I tell these things and people say, you're making that up. And Lisa says, no, that's where we met and fell in love, right? We actually met while we were getting a tuberculosis test. That's how I met my wife. So guys, next time you see a line in a medical clinic, good fishing. Perhaps the most influential event in my life, though, was this. When we moved from Mississippi to New York, what happened was this. There was a family who had found a couple of other families there in Fredonia, New York, outside Buffalo, and they had decided that there needed to be an evangelical work there in the area. There needed to be a Baptist work. There were no other Bible-believing works there in the area, no other churches. And so this group of transplanted Southerners got together and they contacted some people with what's now called the North American Mission Board. Somehow or another, my dad's name became attached with their interest. And we ended up leaving, loading up a U-Haul trailer and a Volkswagen, and driving from Mississippi to New York. And it was an interesting experience. For a while, we met in a Johnny Carson suit factory. I'm not making that up. Then the church finally had enough funds based on some cooperative program monies that came in. You'll see this little thread weaving in here. We were able to get a parsonage. It was an old farmhouse. And the church began to meet in the farmhouse. On Saturday nights, my father would shave our heads. No joke there. We're from South Mississippi. You'd do that to your sons. Burr cuts, y'all know what I'm talking about? Some of y'all have them. So every Saturday night, my father would shave our heads with his clippers. Then we would move all the furniture out of the living room. We'd set up folding chairs, and we would clean our bedrooms. Why did we clean our bedroom? Actually, it was one room we shared, because that was also our Sunday school room. So on Sunday mornings, we would have to get dressed and be ready. Sunday school met in our bedroom. How do you like that, folks? And when I made my public profession of faith, and when my brother at the same time made his public profession of faith, I had a Good Friday service there. It was in our living room. I walked from the seat on the staircase going upstairs and walked down the aisle between folding chairs to make my public profession of faith in the front of our living room. Now, I didn't get baptized in the garage. That came a little bit later. We were trying to baptize people in Lake Erie, but at that time in the early 70s, it kept bursting into flames. It was so polluted. Some of y'all remember that in Cleveland area. And so we had to drive 60 miles to Orchard Park, New York, to get to the closest baptistry. And then finally we were able, through some generosities, to secure a baptistry. And where did we put it? We put it in the garage. You have to imagine what the neighbors thought. It's not enough they're having services in the living room on Sunday mornings. Sometimes they lift the garage door, they stand in the driveway and sing songs, and they dip people under the water. I know they thought we were crazy, but most of them just said, well, they are Southern Baptist. And a little strange. So why was that baptistry in our garage? It was in the garage because my parents answered a call into missions. And that baptistry was in the garage because Southern Baptists all over the United States and the world contributed funds into a thing we call the Cooperative Program. And Cooperative Program funds funneled then through what is now the North American Mission Board went into that mission work with just a handful of families who couldn't afford a full-time pastor. And out of that work, my family was involved with starting something like 9 churches in 7 years, if you can believe that. M.E. Dodd, the father of the Cooperative Program, is partly responsible for putting that garage, putting a baptistry there in the garage. The legacy of people like M.E. Dodd is extensive, and it reaches to every student, alumnus, faculty member, and staff member here in this very auditorium, the George Savage Auditorium, which I'll come back to in a second. Currently, Union receives about $2.3 million from the Tennessee Baptist Convention. That means that each of you who is a student receives about a $1,000 scholarship from convention funds. Your tuition would be $1,000 almost higher, $900 and some. In fact, it can be truly said, M.E. Dodd helped to pay for your tuition, thus the title of my lecture today. So who was this fellow, and what was his vision? Why do we celebrate his life on a day like today? Well, Booker T. Washington is one of my favorite writers, and he's greatly influenced my ideas about education, partly because what he believed was that we should study the theoretical alongside the practical, never separating the two. And he wrote in his memoirs, "The older I grow, the more I'm convinced that there is no education which one can get from books and costly apparatus that's equal to that which can be gotten from contact with great men and women." And that's the idea behind an emphasis like Founders Day. It's for us to come together and to examine the lives of those who have come before us and to lift up our eyes and see the potentials that can be there. Because most of us live self-centered lives that do not look up, but instead cannot see beyond our own little confines and our own little shortcomings and failures. When we look at people like M.E. Dodd, we're able to have a more expansive vision of the world because we can see that people like us have accomplished great things, particularly when they are great things for God. M.E. Dodd is from the Lickskillet community of Tennessee. That's near Trenton or Trennan. Have I been corrected on that correctly? That's just a little bit north of here. And when he was in school, he always assumed he would be a farmer, from what I understand. But there was a Union University student named Forrest Smith who came to his church, Poplar Grove Church there in that area, and led a revival. And as a part of that revival, M.E. Dodd answered the call of Christ into his life. And then Dodd ended up committing himself to go into the ministry, and that's why he ended up here at Union, was as a ministerial student. I was particularly interested to learn that Dodd was the editor of the forerunner of what we call now The Torch. He was the literary editor for Lest We Forget and the other publications like that. And then while he was here, he met a young woman named Emma Savage, who's the daughter of George Savage, Savage Auditorium that we're in now, and he married the president's daughter. That's a pretty good legacy to leave. They married and they embarked on a life of service to God's kingdom. Following graduation, Dodd became pastor of First Baptist Church of Fulton, First Baptist Church Paducah after that, and then of a church in Louisville, Kentucky. And then he went to be pastor of First Baptist Church of Shreveport, Louisiana, which at that time was a good-sized church, large by most standards, but became truly one of the great churches in the Southern Baptist Convention. While Dodd was there, he instilled a number of passions into that church. And I've emailed, actually, some former members of that church and asked them what they remember about his pastorate. And one of them said, "The thing I remember most is that the man would get us on our knees as a church, and we would bow down and pray before God as a part of services." I read someone else who said that that was one of the things he did often at the Southern Baptist Convention. He would get the entire convention to get on their knees and pray before God. It was that sense of humility, of proper perspective, that helped the ministry to grow. A passion for evangelism, a passion for missions, a passion for good stewardship as well. And quickly, the leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention began to draft him into other kinds of leadership opportunities on a national scale. At the time that this was all going on in the 1920s, Southern Baptist life was a life of division. There were theological crises that were facing the convention. There were unbelievable financial challenges that were going on. And the convention was starting to become more and more loose-knit. But Dodd understood something valuable. The solution to those crises, spiritual, financial, structure, everything, could be found in a renewed sacrificial emphasis on missions. In 1925, Dodd's vision for a passionate support of missions, education, and benevolence articulated itself in what we now call the Cooperative Program. And the idea behind the Cooperative Program was this, that all of us would gather together cooperatively and we would focus on the work of Christ through the channeling of our financial resources. The idea was basically this. There are a couple of mutations of it, but the idea was basically this. Churches should tithe. Take 10% of their budgets, send it on into a state office. The state office would keep about 50% and would send another 50% on. Those figures have been monkeyed with based on whatever the particular needs were of areas. But what's happened now is that this amazing thing has come together. The nickels and pennies of millions of Southern Baptists have been converted into billions of dollars in the support of the ministries of the Southern Baptist Convention and ultimately the ministries of Christ. In fact, what we find is that over $10 billion have been donated through the Cooperative Program since that time. Dodd wrote in 1929 that this was the ideal of this. Christ churches today are carrying out in the full program a service of, one, benevolence to the body in orphans, homes, hospitals, and relief work. Two, education of the mind in schools, colleges, seminaries, missionary training institutions. And three, salvation to the heart in evangelistic and missionary enterprises at home and abroad. Body, mind, heart, all affecting the soul. As he began to construct this idea of the Cooperative Program, he wrote this, "The Cooperative Program is intercession in behalf of all of our great causes, which Christ has committed to our trust." Our trust. "We believe that Southern Baptists should go forward together year by year in high and holy endeavor until His kingdom shall stretch from shore to shore, and His name shall be known from the river to the ends of the earth." It's a Jesus program for you students. It's a Jesus thing. Millions of Southern Baptists are pooling their resources for one purpose, to advance the cause of Christ. We are unapologetically committed to winning people to Jesus Christ, and that's our only reason for being. Tennessee Baptists have given $750 million in the last 10 years to this. As a convention, we now have something like 10,000 missionaries at home and abroad. There are about 15,000 students in our seminaries. That doesn't include our affiliated seminaries. Our disaster relief ministries are second probably only to the Red Cross and having amazing effects. When we had the tornadoes here in town, it was the Brotherhood and other groups that just came flying in here as quickly as they could to help take care of things. Our children's villages are national leaders in aiding needy children. Our ministerial annuity program is almost without peer. And our colleges and universities turn out leaders from all over the country in all kinds of walks of life, and those people go on and enrich their communities. But the statistic that means the most is this simple one. In 2002, 816,436 people were baptized in Southern Baptist ministries. I'll read that number again. 816,436. That's 8/10 of a million people. Why would Dodd have such a vision? What drove him to see the larger picture that could generate such successful support of missions? And it's this. Dodd had a perspective on the world that was God's perspective. As I read in that quote, he said, "We're trying to reach to the body, we're trying to reach to the heart, we're trying to reach all these different aspects of people's lives, and we're joining in together to try to do that." Because he understood something. The thing that he understood was that this world is not about this. This world is about this. As Christians, we cannot be materialists. My undergraduate degree was in anthropology. And one of the things they hammer away at in anthropology is what they call cultural materialism. Everything is about material. It's just horizontal. It's stuff. You study stuff. You accumulate stuff and all that. But as Christians, we can't do that. As Christians, we understand that there's a supernatural element. There's a transcendent element. There's a metaphysical element, such that power is not simply about the manipulation and control of people. Sex is not just about sensual pleasure, and money and stewardship is not simply about financial resources. See, for Dodd, he understood this. The highest aim, I'm quoting him, in asking for the church offering is not to get money, but to secure the consecration of manhood. Not coin, but character. Not talents of clinking silver, but talents of mastered manhood. He went on to write, an ounce of energy, a pound of talent, an hour of time, a dollar of money given to the church will go farther, rise higher, sink deeper, spread wider, last longer, and accomplish more than when given to any other cause in the world. And I think that when we read the passage I asked the dean to read this morning, we see where this vision comes from. Let me reread that, Mark chapter 12. It's the passage that is the dominant passage of the last 3 years of my life. I cannot escape this passage. I just come back to it time and time and time again. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked, of all the commandments, which is the most important? The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There's no commandment greater than these. See, what Christ was saying here is a really amazing thing. He says, we have a vertical relationship that causes us to have a horizontal relationship. Is it not fascinating that Christ would anticipate the cross by emphasizing the vertical and the horizontal? Is it not amazing that he himself here is alluding perhaps even to the very incarnation of Christ as God himself came down to walk among us and minister to us? See, when we understand that the world is not just about this, that it starts with this, it causes us to have a completely different perspective on all of the things of the world. And the thing that keeps coming back to me about this passage is this. Orthodoxy means nothing without orthopraxy. Now, I know that's an English guy or a theology guy saying that. What that means is this. If you believe the right things, it means little if you don't do the right things. If you do the right things, it means little if you don't understand and believe the right things. And that's my belief in God makes little difference if it's not combined with right action toward my fellow persons. One of the failures of Christianity in our modern world is the failure to heed this admonition from Christ. We look up to God and then we skip and we put a period at the end of verse 30 and we go, okay, God, we believe in you, but we aren't doing anything about these other folks. The other failure is to skip right over verse 30 and to say, okay, we're going to go help people out. And all we're doing is putting bandages on wounds that never become healed. See, the beauty of all of this is that Christ says we need both, but it starts with this. We must look first to God. In both of these cases where we start with one and we stop with another, we find that selfishness is involved. And so we see churches and institutions dying because they've maintained theological purity while they've ignored the obvious and compelling needs of the communities that surround them. We see churches and institutions dying because they've established social service programs while completely omitting the gospel of Christ. The vision and the wisdom of M.E. Dodd was that the cooperative program would remind us not to think of the horizontal before we do anything else, but to think of the vertical and then to be compelled as an overflow of that into working on the horizontal. Because we cannot love God fully without loving others. It's combined. It merges into one thing. For Southern Baptists, it's the cooperative program that's been our primary inoculation against isolation. Because our polity is one that encourages isolation, independence, priesthood of the believers. And those are the right things. But it's easy for us to fall into traps and become isolated. And Paul is clear, we are members of the body of Christ. And so we must stay focused on God even as we minister to those around us. And the beauty of the cooperative program in Southern Baptist life has been that it's compelled us to fulfill the Great Commandment. By living our lives in accordance with Christ's commands in Luke, we gain God's perspective on this world. Why do we need that? Because most of us are selfish. I see people do this a lot. I know when I was y'all's age, for you students, I used to do this a lot. I'd look at other people and I'd go, he's smarter than I am. He's got a better looking girlfriend. He drives a better car. And the next thing I know, I start getting kind of depressed, you know. Because if you look at other people, you're only going to see the good things. You're not going to find out how much debt they have and what's going on at home and stuff like that. All you see is this other stuff, and you begin to compare yourself. And a professor of mine used to call it navel gazing. Excuse me if I sit down for a second. But he said this. What happens is we often will become selfish, and we'll begin to kind of look down, and we'll kind of go, oh, woe is me. And we become isolated. And at that point, we're looking at ourselves, and we become self-consumed. I'm not as good as anybody else and whatnot. And you become good for nothing at that. And the solution for that is to lift up your eyes and see that your little world is not the only world that's there. To look up to God and gain proper perspective on the world. And then as you do that, you'll see that, in fact, you really probably have it pretty good, even with the problems you have in your life, because somebody always has it worse. If you don't like your house, drive to another part of town and see if you don't like your house better. If you don't like your car, drive to another part of town where nobody has cars or they're all broken down, five of them a yard, and see what you start to think. See, the other part of the selfishness that we get is not just navel-gazing where we sit by ourselves, but it's a cynical arrogance. Here comes Fred Durst, y'all. It's a cynical arrogance that says, I am me, and I'm going to lash out and make sure that you notice me. It's what makes Fred Durst of Limp Bizkit. Here's Limp Bizkit. It's what makes Fred Durst say, it's going to do my way. It's my way or the highway. It's what makes Gwen Stefani say, it's my life. Don't you forget. For those of you who understand those references, it's what makes Frank Sinatra sing, I did it my way. Well, I got news, Fred. It's not your way. It's God's way. Got news, Gwen. It's not your life. It's God's life. Even to the chairman of the board, I have to say, it's not about doing it my way. It's about doing it God's way. In fact, if you do it God's way, it might even reduce some of those regrets you had along the way. So how does Dodd's vision work its way here at Union? Living in the proper perspective, touted in Mark 12, lies at the core of what we do here at Union. One of my mentors, Aubrey Lucas, who's the former president of the University of Southern Miss, where I did my PhD, he's an influential leader in Methodist higher education. And once he told me this, education is about causing people to lift up their eyes and see that the world is much larger than they ever dreamed it could possibly be. As a university community, Union has articulated this view and the view of Mark in this way. We strive to be Christ-centered and people-focused. Those are the first two parts of our goals here. We look to God as the source of all knowledge and truth, and then we look to the best of what has been thought by others. That's the educational part. And we do that so that we can affect change in this world for the sake of the gospel. Such a worldview requires us to think redemptively. As John Milton, the great writer, wrote, the purpose of education is to repair the ruins of our first parents by regaining to know God aright, and out of that knowledge to love Him, to imitate Him, to be like Him, by possessing our souls of true virtue, which being united to the heavenly grace of faith makes up the highest perfection. And this, in fact, is at the core of the Christian humanistic enterprise. We look up to understand God. We want to know Him better, so we then begin to look around and find everything we can that will give us insight into the nature and character of God. We want to understand more about God. We begin to study science and understand that God is an orderly God who reveals Himself in many ways. We want to understand how God feels about people. We read literature so that we can be reminded of the commonalities that we have. And I could go through any academic endeavor and do that exact same thing. Dodd himself was no stranger to Christian education. In fact, he was president of a college for almost 20 years, Dodd College. And in his classic book, Missions Our Mission, he actually outlined his view of Christian education. Nowadays, we call this outcomes assessment. That's the big Sachs term. This is what Dodd wrote. Schools under the domination of material philosophers will turn out materialists. Schools under the dominating spirit of Jesus Christ turn out men and women of Christian ideals and principles in life. There may be occasional exceptions, as there are to all rules, but the character of the students reveals the character of the school. A tree is known by its fruits. It's kind of scary, students, isn't it? I quickly came to love this place, Union, because as I came here, and I still remember walking down that long hall the first time and feeling this sense that something's going on here, and feeling like I wanted to come and join this, I became to understand, especially as I was reading Dodd's writings, that we are, in fact, trying our best to fulfill this vision and to live up to this perspective. I look at my colleagues out here front and center, and I see in them this desperate desire to teach in a way that's distinctively Christian and rigorously intellectual. I look at my coworkers and staff side of things, and I look at how they try to encourage people around here and work with people and just try to help and pitch in. And I look at chapel when I'm here on Wednesdays and Fridays, and I look at your students while you're singing and when Lance is up here, even if he's barefoot, and I think how passionate so many of them are about trying to discover what God wants in their lives. And I can't help but smile. And when I see this institution's leaders, like those behind me, who have committed themselves to upholding Union's mission by offering conferences for Union leaders, mission opportunities, financial support for children of missionaries and Tennessee Baptist Church members, I know that Demi Dodd himself must be smiling up there in that great cloud of witnesses where he now can see us. And I'm proud to be able to represent an institution that treats cooperative program gifts as a sacred entrustment rather than as an entitlement that carries no responsibilities. So here comes OJ. I grew up in Buffalo, outside Buffalo there in Fredonia. OJ was my hero. I got to meet him once. Dad got to do Fellowship of Christian Athletes. On a Saturday morning, we got free tickets to the game. Mission pastors do not get tickets to the game with any money. So we're relying on the charity of Bob James, some other guys. And we got tickets to the game. Dad let church out that day at 11:20. It was 20 degrees, 12 inches of snow during the game. He made us take our shoes off so we could hold our feet up to his stomach so we wouldn't get frostbite. OJ gained about 220 yards that game, something like that, against New England Patriots. It was amazing. And I just idealized this guy. I love it. I broke his record in the backyard so many times. And I was so tickled to finally meet him. And I remember reading everything I could, interviews and all. He was explaining his approach to running and all that. And this is what he said about running. Somebody said, "What's your great idea?" And he said this: "When I'm running, I keep my eye on the end zone. I keep my eye on the goalposts." He said, "Because if I look at these guys, I'm down. If I'm worried about what's around here, I'm down. And if you watch pictures or video, you will always see, even when he's doing this on guys while he's got the ball in his arm, his eyes are up. He's always looking like that." Because what he said was, if you keep focused on the goal, you don't get distracted by all of this stuff. This is taken care of. Your eyes are on the goal. Last week I was watching kids at church in front of a mirror. They were posing. I was laughing. There was a little boy, there was a little girl. She was posing and doing all this, and little boy's doing Spider-Man, and they're just cracking me up. But you know, that's the way a lot of us live our lives. We're busy in front of the mirror, and we're looking at our own stuff, and they weren't even paying attention that people were over here kind of going, you know. Where are you looking? God calls us to live our lives in a proper relationship with Him. It's not about obedience and all that. It's about relationship. Have you considered His priority in your life? Are you looking up? Is God the focus of your life, your worship, your study? Are you looking around? Are you serving others? Are you encouraging them? Are you living up to the legacy of godly persons like M.E. Dodd, who went before us and who provide us with great examples of Christ's likeness? God provided M.E. Dodd with a vision of excellence and cooperation. God provided my family an offer of the opportunity to have a baptistry in our garage. God's blessed Union with a central and significant place in Christian higher education. So what's God's plan for you? Look up to Him and see where this perspective will take you. You never know. You just might end up with a baptistry in your garage.